the defining maxim, if you will, of America since its founding has been that in America, no man is above the law.
Yeah, well, how quaint. That was then, this is now. We'll all get over it.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
That's why.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
No, it's not.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
I am.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA. Also in California, in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI and Round Mountains KKRN. Up in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Fairmont, West Virginia's WEFR, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, and Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast every day and around the globe on the internet, on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites, blanketing planet Earth. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today as we try to continue to get caught up with the world on today's thrilling and delightful Bradcast. Welcome to it. Glad to have you here. That chuckle you heard, of course, is Desi Doyen, our producer. How are you, Desiree?
Doing okay after historic weeks in U.S. history.
Yeah, no kidding. And we're going to try to catch up with, one of those historic, one of those things that made last week historic, at least one of those things, in just a moment. But as we go to air, more than 2 million customers in Texas are without power as more record heat now sets in for the Lone Star State following the record-breaking Hurricane Beryl storming ashore, leaving a disturbingly early, deadly storm season disaster and cleanup in its wake. According to state officials, restoring power to millions of Texans could actually take days or as much as 2 weeks in some places, posing a dangerous scenario for residents without air condition as a triple-digit heat index hits the state. I think that's, Desi Doyen, one of those compounding errors that you have often warned us about that many climate scientists fear most.
Yes.
With several different disasters happening at once.
Right. So in this case, you have, extreme flooding and you have extreme wind damage. And then you also have the power outage on top of a heat wave. So it's going on at the same time. And Houston officials are grappling with how to help everybody all at once.
And heat remains, of course, the single biggest cause of weather-related deaths in this country by far. At least 8 people are already reported dead as of this hour in Texas and Louisiana following the landfall of Beryl. It was the first storm in the Atlantic hurricane season to make landfall in the U.S., and it marks an early and deadly start to a hurricane season that experts say will be far from normal as fossil fuel pollution causes abnormally warm water and rapidly intensifying storms that we are seeing more and more of each and every year. The center of the storm arrived Tuesday morning in Arkansas before it heads into southern Missouri and Illinois. It's then expected to blow into Kentucky and Indiana on Wednesday morning and through Ohio and Michigan and into Canada by the end of the week, expecting to spawn severe thunderstorms, tornadoes, and flooding in a number of regions along the way.
So now is a great time to buckle up for some flooding for you folks up there in the Midwest. Sorry about that. It's also a good time, no matter where you are, to go ahead and make sure that you are ready for these surprise emergency extreme weather events, because they do come up all of a sudden.
14 tornadoes from Beryl were reported on Monday alone in Texas, Louisiana, and southern Arkansas, compounding the compounding disasters and leaving almost 25 million Americans under flood watches as oppressive heat affects millions of others, particularly in parts of the West where the heat has been really bad. Desi Doyen will have more on that and, unfortunately, too many other predictable climate-related disasters in real life. And, by the way, from the Supreme Court from over the past week or so while we were out in our latest Green News report, catching up with things later this hour. And speaking of disasters from our corrupt, radical, extremist, and not conservative in the least U.S. Supreme Court that we were not here to cover last week, as you may have heard, on the very last day of its term last week, which that term was extended into July for the first time in years, the court finally got around to issuing its ruling in what had otherwise been regarded for months by every single court and almost every single legal expert in the nation, except for the ones that were hired by Donald Trump, as the disgraced former president's ridiculous argument that former presidents have absolute immunity from any and all crimes they committed while serving in office. Of course, you grew up, you heard that presidents were not kings, that the very idea of America was based on that, was about breaking away from a king. So we all thought it was ridiculous until the U.S. Supreme Court thought otherwise. Most thought that the high court, as packed and corrupted and captured by far-right Republicans as it is, would not even take up this case after it was soundly and unanimously defeated by both the U.S. District Court and a federal appeals panel, which concurred with the district court in no uncertain terms that, quote, presidents are not kings and Donald Trump is not the president, by the way. And yet, nonetheless, this court found an imaginary clause in the U.S. Constitution that no one knew was there, determining in a 6-3 ruling that, yes, though no one had noticed for about, 2.5 centuries or so, presidents actually are absolutely immune from core constitutional official acts that are carried out by the president and presumptively immune from almost every other act that they take while serving. Writing in dissent to this absurd ruling, but one that I guess we're stuck with, writing in dissent joined by the court's two other liberals, Justice Sonia Sotomayor excoriated the ruling, writing, quote, "Today's decision to grant former presidents criminal immunity reshapes the institution of the presidency. It makes a mockery of the principle foundational to our Constitution and system of government that no man is above the law." Relying on little more than its own misguided wisdom about the need for, quote, bold and unhesitating action by the president, the court gives former President Trump all the immunity he asked for and more. She goes on to note that our Constitution, quote, does not shield a former president from answering for criminal and treasonous acts. She described Special Counsel Jack Smith's federal indictment against Donald Trump related to his failed attempts to steal the 2020 election as, quote, a stark portrait of a president desperate to stay in power. She describes the majority's ruling as, quote, just as bad as it sounds, unquote, and describes it as baseless and nonsensical, in which, quote, argument by argument, the majority invests immunity through brute force. She says, on behalf of the minority, that it is, quote, deeply wrong, illogical, unprecedented, and warns that it will, quote, have disastrous consequences for the presidency and for our democracy. Well, how do you really feel about it, Justice Sotomayor? This official acts immunity, she writes, going on to quote, ironically, it seems, from the court's ruling in Dobbs that overturned Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health, which overturned Roe v. Wade, has, quote, no firm grounding in constitutional text, history, or precedent, unquote. Which is the exact reason that the court's right-wing, not conservative majority cited for overturning the right to reproductive freedom. They said, oh, it has no firm grounding in constitutional text, history, or precedent. Well, apparently this immunity decision has none of the above either. No matter how you look at it, the majority's official acts immunity is utterly indefensible, she said. The Constitution's text contains no provision for immunity from criminal prosecution for former presidents. The omission in the text of the Constitution is worth noting, she writes, for at least three reasons. First, the framers clearly knew how to provide for immunity from prosecution. They did provide a narrow immunity for legislators in the Speech or Debate Clause, Article 1, Section 6 of the Constitution. But they did not extend the same or similar immunity to presidents. So they knew they could have, they just didn't. Second, she says, some state constitutions at the time of the framing specifically provided express criminal immunities to sitting governors. So, yes, despite Republican justices long claiming to be textualists, asserting that we must follow the actual text of the founding document as opposed to imagined liberal interpretations of it, immunity for presidents is nowhere to be found in the text of the Constitution. Those very same justices, by the way, for years have also claimed to be originalists, asserting that one must look at the original intent of the drafters in order to determine the meaning of any particular clause. Well, since we know that the framers knew about the concept of immunity and they offered it on a limited basis to members of Congress, but they chose not to do so for the executive, clearly the originalist intent of the framers was to not give immunity to the president. As Sotomayor continues, the framers chose not to include similar language in the Constitution to immunize the president. If the framers had wanted to create some constitutional privilege to shield the president from criminal indictment, they could have done so. But they did not. Third, she writes, insofar as the Constitution does speak to this question, it actually contemplates some form of criminal liability for former presidents. The majority ignores that the impeachment judgment clause presumes the availability of criminal process against presidents by establishing that an official impeached and convicted by the Senate, quote, shall nevertheless be liable and subject to indictment, trial, judgment, and punishment according to law. That clause, she notes, clearly contemplates that a former president may be subject to criminal prosecution for the same conduct that resulted or could have resulted in an impeachment judgment, including conduct such as bribery, which implicates official action almost by definition. Near the conclusion of her 30-page dissent, after disemboweling the corrupt majority ruling point by point, she writes, looking beyond the fate of this particular prosecution, the long-term consequences of today's decision are stark. The court effectively creates a law-free zone around the president, upsetting the status quo that has existed since the founding. This new official acts immunity now lies about like a loaded weapon for any president that wishes to place his own interests, his own political survival, or his own financial gain above the interests of the nation. The president of the United States is the most powerful person in the country and possibly the world. When he uses his official powers in any way under the majority's reasoning, he now will be insulated from criminal prosecution. Orders the Navy's SEAL Team 6 to assassinate a political rival? Immune. Organizes a military coup to hold on to power? Immune. Takes a bribe in exchange for a pardon? Immune. 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 That's Sotomayor writing, not me saying it. Let the president violate the law. Let him exploit the trappings of his office for personal gain. Let him use his official power for evil ends, because if he knew that he may one day face liability for breaking the law, he might not be as bold and fearless as we would like him to be. That's the majority's message today, she writes. The relationship between the president and the people he serves has shifted irrevocably. In every use of official power, the president is now a king above the law. In the wake of this monumental ruling from the court, where they literally wrote a new immunity clause into the Constitution that does not and never did exist, widely respected, very, very conservative former federal judge Michael Luttig, appointed to the bench by Ronald Reagan, considered several times by Republican presidents himself for the Supreme Court, responded this way to this previously unimaginable opinion.
The Supreme Court's decision in Trump against United States represents the unsouling of America. America's democracy and the rule of law are the heart and soul of America. It is our democracy and the rule of law that has made America the envy of the world and the beacon of freedom to the world for almost 250 years. The Supreme Court cut the heart and soul out of America with this abominable decision. The defining maxim, if you will, of America since its founding has been that in America, no man is above the law. That can never be said about America again after Monday's decision by the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court of the United States held that the President of the United States, and in particular, the former President of the United States, Donald Trump, is above the law.
So yes, as Sotomayor wrote, it is as bad as it sounds. I wanted to read, you know, just a few extended passages from Sotomayor's minority dissent, because as alarming as the court's outrageous majority opinion was, it also came amidst the national freakout over Joe Biden's performance in the first presidential debate just days earlier. And as many like us were already out and about taking some time off for the 4th of July holiday. As insane as the ruling was and is, I don't think it has fully set in what it means for the future, and in particular, as Judge Luttig notes, for Donald Trump and for the U.S., should he be allowed to step foot in the White House as president ever again. Even now, I don't feel that I've done enough to either drive that point home or what this decision by the corrupt Roberts Court and a number of other ones that they made at term's end mean for the power of the court itself. As it culminates a massive shift in power, a massive power grab for the judicial branch. So let me take a quick break here. We'll be joined by legal expert Chris Geidner to discuss more on the above, because I think we need to sort of come to terms with this somehow over the next few weeks and months and years. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back with Chris Geidner to discuss it right after this. I'm Brad Friedman, and you are listening to the Bradcast.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor. The rich get rich, that's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Do they? I'm not sure everybody knows, or at least fully understand, what actually happened at the U.S. Supreme Court just over 1 week ago. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Quote, "Never in the history of our republic has a president had reason to believe that he would be immune from criminal prosecution if he used the trappings of his office to violate the criminal law. Moving forward, however, all former presidents will be cloaked in such immunity," writes Justice Sonia Sotomayor at the end of her blistering 30-page dissent. On behalf of the court's liberal appointees, in response to the corrupt, extremist, radical, not conservative in the least, Supreme Court majority's shocking ruling in Trump v. U.S. offering absolute immunity for most so-called core constitutional official acts of a U.S. president and presumptive immunity, whatever that may turn out to mean, for almost all other acts taken while in office. Quote, "If the occupant of that office," Sotomayor concludes, "misuses official power for personal gain, the criminal law that the rest of us must abide by will not provide a backstop. With fear for our democracy," she writes, "I dissent." As you may have guessed, I dissent as well. I join her fear for our democracy, though that fear for me certainly had set in long before last week's ruling, even if that has certainly served as a confirmation that my fear has not been overwrought. Yes, the court's ruling, no matter what it had actually said, had already stalled Trump's federal prosecution for attempting to steal the 2020 election long enough that it almost certainly would not have been tried before the 2024 election. And yes, now that the ruling has come out, it means that it may never come to trial if he wins that election, and might be greatly restricted in its charges and evidence even if he does not. But beyond the immediate charges that Trump is facing, the broader context of last week's ruling is almost more chilling, if that's possible, for what it means for our constitutional republic moving forward, which I want to speak about with my guest momentarily. And while the Supreme Court's ruling adds remarkable, previously unimaginable, and otherwise nowhere to be found in the Constitution, monarchical powers to the office of the presidency, as Chris Geithner recently observed in his excellent Law Dork newsletter, that opinion and a whole bunch of others by the right-wing majority at term's end this year paradoxically added a whole bunch of power to the Supreme Court itself, in what Geithner characterizes as a massive power grab for the judicial branch at the expense of the other two, theoretically the other two co-equal branches of government, which were carefully established by the founders of the Constitution. Joining us now is our friend Chris Geithner, an award-winning veteran legal journalist focused on, among other things, the U.S. Supreme Court at his newsletter site, LawDork.com, which has been running now for some 20 years. He also previously served as legal editor for BuzzFeed News, editor-in-chief of the Ohio State Law Journal, and as a contributor to the New York Times, MSNBC, and other outlets. Chris Geithner, welcome back, and thank you for joining us following what I know has been an exhausting several weeks for folks like you trying to make sense out of what just happened at this Supreme Court.
Yes. I should say, I originally started Law Dork as a blog more than 20 years ago, but I have taken several breaks from it. This latest iteration as a newsletter just started 2 years ago.
Don't give me any ideas about taking a break from a blog, Chris.
Yeah, I would hate to do that.
Yeah, I may run with that idea.
I mean, I don't think I really took a break so much as just like took on other responsibilities, yes, as assigned.
Gotcha. In any event, I'm going to continue to push folks over to your Substack newsletter site at lawdork.com. Listen, I want to discuss several excellent points that you made in some of your recent pieces at Law Dork about how the court has, through several decisions this term, radically gathered power for itself via a number of its rulings. But I don't know if we've ever seen anything as radical from this court or any other in our nation's history, in fact, that has been as, historically unprecedented, expansive, and, as I say, not conservative as the immunity ruling in Trump v. U.S. Last week. So I need to start with several points there. First, Chris, your top line, after a week you've had now to ponder it, what this ruling means in the broadest sense, before I ask you to sort of drill down into some very specific results that could come because of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line is that the Supreme Court majority that has its conservative control over the court made a decision that it would allow it to retain as much power as possible while also giving Trump an unprecedented, unjustified out from significant parts of the prosecutions that he was going to be facing with no basis in the text of the Constitution.
And no basis in the Constitution is one of the reasons why I say it's not conservative. It's not a conservative majority. Conservatives aren't supposed to add, make up clauses for the Constitution, which is essentially what happened here. And sort of further underscoring that, Chris, during the oral argument in this case, Justice Neil Gorsuch had said out loud that they were making a, quote, ruling for the ages here.
Yes.
Why? Doesn't the court usually conservatively decide only as much as they have to? Do they need to make a ruling for the ages in order to decide simply if Donald Trump, could face federal prosecution for his various acts in trying to steal the 2020 election?
Yeah, I mean, it was an obnoxious statement in arguments to be like, that is sort of typical Gorsuch. That's like, by the way, are you aware that we're very important? But I mean, let's face it, when the U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a case over the confines of prosecutorial authority mm-hmm. over former presidents, it almost definitionally is going to be a ruling for the ages.
But it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be, right? Couldn't they say
it does? Yeah. We've only had. No, I'm sorry. I'm going to push back.
Okay.
On that. Like,
okay.
Like it is the U.S. Supreme Court issuing a decision about what the Constitution says about the prosecution of presidents. It could have been easy. I don't think they got it right, mm-hmm. but that doesn't mean that it would have been a decision for the ages the other way if they had just upheld the DC circuit and said, look, you're now a citizen again, Donald.
Mm-hmm. Well, right.
A one-page decision. That would have been a decision for the ages too.
Well, it would have left open the notion that there are some crimes that could be charged, others that couldn't. I mean, they could have said, yes, you can be the charges in this particular indictment. Are constitutional. We don't have any problem, and we don't have to decide any further. They didn't have to decide further, Chris.
I think this is the first time we've had a disagreement.
Okay.
I mean, in some ways, what you're suggesting would have been an even greater power grab. They didn't. Mm. I mean, they didn't decide a lot of these. That's one of my problems with the decision, is they didn't ultimately decide. The only thing that they really said was out was the DOJ, the parts of the indictment that related to his interactions with the Justice Department.
Right.
They said that counts as within the core power. In terms of his interactions with Pence and efforts to pressure Pence, they said that fell into that center area of there's a presumption that it's going to be immune, but the prosecutor could rebut it. But then as to the third area, the everything else in the indictment, the efforts at the fake electors in particular, they said, I mean, that was where they sort of just like tossed the potato back and said, yeah, even some of this stuff Trump's lawyer said aren't official acts, but we're going to allow the district court to decide that.
Right.
And so in some ways, I mean, what I've talked about in the aftermath is there's a lot of elements here where they didn't decide everything, and they sort of like left it to possible like future rulings where they could say, oh, Chutkan got that wrong, and this part of the indictment should have been tossed out. And then we get into those questions about like, well, if that part of the indictment had been tossed out, would that have led to a different decision in the case? And do we need to toss the entire conviction out?
All of which, of course, gives them, as you note, more power down the road as they get to continue deciding this case. So, Chris, setting this case aside, if that's even possible for the moment, since we have a ruling for the ages.
A whole term.
Yes. We have this ruling for the ages. So I'd like to, you know, run through very quickly, if possible, a series of potential ramifications of this ruling as it is written now, since I'm not sure that people fully understand or even believe that it could be true, and or I'm hoping that maybe it's not true. Maybe I'm missing something. There's something I'm misunderstanding here. Some of these may be simple yes-no answers at this point.
Yes.
Some may be more complicated. So let me just run through a few of these that I've been thinking about over the past week. The presidential pardon power, that is a core constitutional power of the presidency, you know, such as those described by the court as now enjoying absolute immunity, you know, that can't be
unreviewable.
Right.
You could literally start auctioning off pardons.
Well, that's what I want to understand. If a president literally says, hey, for $100,000 a pop, I'll give a pardon to anyone, he cannot be prosecuted for that, period. Is that correct?
So here's, this was the debate actually in a footnote that Roberts and Barrett got into. So you have these three areas of the core functions of the presidency. Then you have the outer perimeter of official acts where you have the presumption. Then you have unofficial acts that aren't covered. Then there was a fourth part of the ruling that was a 5-4 decision. And Barrett did not join this part. And what the court said there is that you can't even use anything within those outer perimeter of official acts as evidence in non-official act prosecutions. And so the specific instance that Barrett kept talking about was bribery. And she talked about this in the oral argument. She talked about this in her opinion. And Roberts tried to push back in a footnote. She said, so you're not even going to be able to provide evidence of a pardon that was granted in a bribery case. Now, what Robert said is you don't need to get into things because you would be able to show the effect just through like a news article or something. You wouldn't need to actually like turn over documents from the White House into evidence in order to prove that there was a pardon issue.
Or get testimony from a, you know, a White House official who says...
You wouldn't be able to get testimony.
Yeah.
You wouldn't be able to do that.
So the president says to his staffer, hey, go out and sell pardons for $100,000. The staffer would not be required to come and testify that the president told me to go sell pardons for $100,000.
The staffer could face charges. At least for now.
Okay. So let me go through some more of these because they're all so troubling. The court.
I mean, keep in mind, just like we have executive privilege that like filters down and the president can invoke executive privilege for like staffers and say, I don't want this staffer to testify because of executive privilege. You're now going to have questions about whether that comes into play in, I don't know, say, Mark Meadows' prosecution down in Georgia.
Right.
He's going to say the president has this constitutional immunity, and by prosecuting me, you are watering down the power of that immunity.
Right.
And so therefore, the president should be able to invoke that immunity to prevent my prosecution.
Gotcha.
I don't know if that works, but we're going to have to deal with that.
Well, don't worry about if it works, Chris. We'll just have the Supreme Court decide whether it works.
They'll
a little bit later.
It, time by time.
There you go. All right. During oral argument, Trump's attorney, this is, of course, the most famous one. His attorneys argued that a president can order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate his political opponents, could not be held criminally liable for that unless he was tried and convicted in an impeachment proceeding first. So did SCOTUS just actually agree to that?
Well, this is the ridiculous, nonsensical part of, I mean, one of the several ridiculous, nonsensical parts of the opinion, is that the opinion specifically says that it doesn't go with Trump's argument that you need to have impeachment and conviction before you can face criminal charges. But by saying that you don't need to go that far, it's interesting that there are elements of prosecutions that clearly, under the plain constitutional text of how the impeachment clause works, in those instances, there are things that this opinion now says presidents are immune from that the impeachment clause specifically contemplates presidents being able to be prosecuted for after impeachment.
But even setting aside impeachment and whether they're convicted or not, it seems to me that this ruling says, yeah, you know, only a president basically gives orders.
This is what I'm saying. Yeah. Is, I mean, you're right. Like, the plain text of the ruling says the SEAL Team 6 thing is 100% allowed.
Yeah.
My issue is that in the opinion, Robert says Trump's argument that you can only prosecute a president after impeachment and conviction is wrong. We don't go that far.
Right.
He specifically contemplates that as like going further than what the Supreme Court did. But as you point out, even under Trump's interpretation of that clause, anything that a president is impeached and convicted over, they can then face criminal charges from. So now my question is, under the scenario, under the world as John laid out by John Roberts, does that mean that a criminal prosecution for a SEAL Team 6 assassination is or is not allowed if there's impeachment and conviction?
Well, I don't think we're ever going to see a conviction for impeachment in the U.S. Senate again at this point. So I'm not even thinking about that. I'm just thinking, you know, hey, can Joe Biden now, you know, order SEAL Team 6 to assassinate Supreme Court justices that he doesn't like if he wanted to under this ruling?
It is hard for me to read in the ruling where that is not allowed. I mean, but here's the thing, and I sort of got into this in my like day three piece where I the spinelessness of John Roberts. I think that when you look at this ruling along with several other rulings of the court, they basically leave themselves enough wiggle room to basically change the ruling in the future if they want.
Right.
Like,
yeah.
So when you and I look at this core function of the presidency, this top tier of absolute immunity, like we can say it's pardons, it's the power to declare war, it's maybe some elements of national security and immigration. But when you look at what John Roberts said, he said it also includes appointment power, because that's an absolute power that we've said under all these appointments clause rulings, trying to get rid of independent agencies, that is a core presidential power. Then not only did he therefore expand this core presidential power of absolute immunity to any appointment of any official. But he then basically said that you're allowed to one step away from that even. Since the appointment power is a core power, any discussion that Donald Trump had with senior DOJ officials mm-hmm. about the leadership of the Justice Department mm-hmm. is therefore protected under that core power. So therefore, any presidential discussion with anybody who is appointed within anywhere in the executive branch is now apparently a core power of the presidency.
Well, what would be under this
so
rule?
So what's not a core power?
Yeah, I know. Well, not only what is not a core power, I'm trying to figure out, frankly, what is a crime? What in this case, what is a high crime? What is a high crime and misdemeanor for a president?
Well, that's totally separate. See, this is the thing.
Okay.
And this is where this ruling, I think, ultimately is eventually someday, maybe let's assume we get through this moment in time.
Uh-huh.
Relatively no more scathed than we already are.
Uh-huh, good luck.
This is a ruling that is going to fall in on itself over time, because the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors, as the court has made clear, let's remember, impeachment exists for a lot of officials other than president. Mm-hmm. And while we have never had a president removed, we have had other officials convicted,
mm-hmm.
and we've had judges convicted. We've had lower officials convicted. The fact is that there is case law on that. And the answer is that high crimes and misdemeanors are basically whatever the Senate says. They have nothing to do with crimes. That is a political phrase.
Yes.
That is up to the Senate to decide.
Well, that's fair enough. But I would add, it seems to me, and again, you're the expert, I'm not, but it seems to me that if you're, you know, looking for evidence to vote against an impeachment in the Senate, you would say, well, this cannot be a high crime against a president because a president can't be held liable for any particular crime.
I think that was sort of a circular argument
uh-huh.
that both sides were trying to use. That's like saying that a homonym means it's the same word.
Well, listen.
I mean, it's not. A high crime and misdemeanor is not a crime.
Okay. Well, listen, they were the ones making a ruling for the ages. It seems to me like they could have clarified these things, Chris. Let me ask you.
No, they certainly could. I mean, hey, it was a bad ruling. It was poorly written. It was not based in law. But that's not the only one we got this term.
And we're going to get to that in a second. But let me ask about this one. Here's what Donald Trump's Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, told 60 Minutes about what Donald Trump had wanted the military to do back in 2020 in response to American citizens protesting following the murder of George Floyd.
What specifically was he suggesting that the U.S. military should do to these protesters?
He says, can't you just shoot them? Just shoot them in the legs or something. And he's suggesting that that's what we should do, that we should bring in the troops and shoot the protesters.
The commander-in-chief was suggesting that the U.S. military shoot protesters.
Yes, in the streets
American
of our nation's capital. That's right.
Donald Trump's own former Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, saying that Donald Trump had told him, hey, why don't we just shoot these peaceful protesters in the streets? Now, Chris Geithner, had Mark Esper said, okay, let's do that, or had Donald Trump decided to do that in a future term of office, would that be immunized behavior if it had actually happened?
So here's the two answers to that. The one is, under the plain terms of Trump versus United States, the answer is it's allowed. And he's immune. Well, no. See, the answer in this, there is some confusion in the way that people are talking about this. The answer is the president cannot be criminally charged.
Right.
That does not mean that something is legal.
Okay, yeah. But he can't be criminally charged.
The federal government could and likely would face 1983 actions. There could be other violations. Again, lower people who are not named the president
right.
could face charges.
Yeah, they're still facing charges for not...
There could be the Uniform Code of Military...
Right.
Uniform Code of Justice.
Right. Yes.
UMCJ. That's right. UCMJ.
Right.
Uniform Code of Military Justice. I mean, I get now regularly in my mentions on social media, whenever you say anything, they say, can't Biden just do that now? The Supreme Court said the presidents can do anything in their core power. Like somebody said that response today about student loans. Here's the thing, like, no, they didn't. They just said you can't send Joe Biden to jail over it. They didn't say that courts can't strike things down.
Well, courts can strike things down, but they can't strike down, you know, if they shoot people in the streets. Sure, they could charge Mark Esper had he followed an unlawful order. They couldn't charge Donald Trump. And by the way, Donald Trump could have pardoned Mark Esper. And since we can't question the pardon power, everybody stays out of jail, whether it's, you know, we want to call
everybody could stay out
criminal
of jail
or not.
If it's early in a president's term and it happened, yes. But now the second answer to this is, you can always, and we see the court do this lots of times when we don't want them to, but here's the perfect example. We saw this term in the case over the federal ban on people with a domestic violence restraining order out against them having a firearm, when John Roberts, also another John Roberts special, John Roberts said, oh, I think that the lower courts misunderstood our ruling in Bruin a few years back. Uh-huh. We certainly didn't mean that you couldn't enforce this law. Now, of course, the guy who wrote Bruin, Clarence Thomas, was the one to sentence that and said, no, that's exactly
what we meant. Yeah, exactly.
But this is the reality that because the Supreme Court is, what is it? The Supreme Court is not
infallible.
Final because it's infallible. It is infallible because it's final. Any word in this however many page ruling in Trump v. U.S. that I have in my hand right now, John Roberts found this presidential right in invisible ink in the Constitution, he can also find asterisks in invisible ink in Trump versus United States,
right,
that they could simply say, no, obvious. Like, you can imagine, just like, go and read Rahimi and tell me that you can't imagine John Roberts in 6 years, if a president after Biden, Democrat or Republican, does something that is horrid, and that person says, I have immunity under Trump v. U.S., and you can just see a John Roberts opinion being like, well, I'm sorry, but the Fifth Circuit clearly misunderstood Trump versus U.S.
We didn't.
That a president going into Louisiana and down to New Orleans and opening fire on residents who he decided voted for his opponent clearly is not within his core
powers. That's not what we meant in
U.S.
for Trump.
Therefore, he can face charges.
Right. I mean it seems
the reality is that when you don't actually resolve anything, you just set up these new standards, and they don't say how Jack Smith can rebut the presumption. They don't say how Judge Chutkan should ultimately make the determination of whether something's an official act. They don't really define core. They just say that they think that the DOJ communications were. When you've done that, you really do leave it open to turn it into a Rorschach test moving forward.
Yeah. This ruling, I was going to ask, you know, how it might ever be overturned. And I think you've already supplied the answer. It will be overturned when this court decides they want to overturn it, when it decides they want to change it, decides when they say, yeah, well, that's not what we meant. My guess is it will probably be, you know, when it's a Democratic president who is being held to account for something like this, then
it'll
either be a new
Supreme Court or a Democratic president.
Yeah, that's it. All right, brother. And it was, by the way, I'm going to point folks, of course, to your article headlined "The Supreme Court's Declaration of Independence a Few Days Early," because it is not just this case, unfortunately, where the Supreme Court, as you note, grabbed a whole bunch of power from both the executive branch and the legislative branch for themselves to be the ultimate arbiters of, at this point, everything, even life or death decisions made by a U.S. president. I'll point folks over to that article. Chris Geidner, his work can be found, of course, at lawdork.com. I strongly suggest you sign up for his newsletter. You can also follow him on the Twitters at Chris Geidner and at Law Dork News. Thank you, Chris. Hope you get some rest this summer. We're going to need you in good shape in the fall.
We'll see about that, but
all right.
We'll try. Thanks a lot, Brad.
Thank you, my friend. Okay, quick break and more Supreme Court corruption and Desi Doyen's Green News Report coming up right after this. I'm Brad Friedman. You are listening to the Bradcast. You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate. Not enough nightmares for you today? Don't worry, we got you covered in our latest Green News Report.
Beyond all the water, there are still significant power outages across this region.
Hurricane Beryl barrels into Texas as 140 million Americans suffer amid record heat wave. U.S. Supreme Court's right-wing supermajority delivers big for polluters. Plus,
extreme heat is the number one weather-related killer in the United States. More people die from extreme heat than floods, hurricanes, and tornadoes combined.
Biden unveils first-ever standards to protect workers from extreme heat.
About time. All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Ignoring climate change is deadly and dangerous and irresponsible. It's not only outrageous, it's really stupid.
Yeah, but the fossil fuel industry doesn't give you $1 billion because they think you're smart. Am I right, Donald Trump? This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, we've been off for a week, but I assume, like everywhere else, it has been a slow news week in the climate change space.
Oh, I wish it were so.
Oh.
First up, ferocious record-breaking Hurricane Beryl slammed into Matagorda, Texas, as a Category 1 hurricane on Monday. That after weaving a path of destruction across the Caribbean and Mexico's Yucatan Peninsula, where the storm killed at least 11 people. Beryl brought intense flooding to the Houston region, knocking out power for millions and killing at least three. The storm zoomed from tropical storm to Category 4 in just 42 hours to become the earliest Category 4 and Category 5 Atlantic hurricane ever recorded. Those usually don't happen until September.
And why would that be?
Because it was fueled by record hot oceans, caused by man-made global warming, and driven by the burning of fossil fuels.
Huh.
Experts say intense storms are occurring more frequently thanks to climate change.
Well, this is pretty early for a storm this big, ain't it?
Yep. 146 million people in the U.S. are still suffering under an extended extreme heat wave that is forecast to shatter more temperature records across the nation in coming days.
Oh, yeah, there's that, too.
Several cities set new all-time high temperature records. Palm Springs hit 124 degrees Fahrenheit. Red in Northern California hit 119. Las Vegas hit 120. In Portland, Oregon, intense heat is suspected in the deaths of at least four people. But tourists from around the world flocked to California's Death Valley to experience its near-record 129 degrees.
Good Lord.
And yes, heat extremes are happening more frequently. Climate Central found that man-made global warming has made long-lasting extreme heat waves four to five times more likely. Here's Texas Tech climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe on NBC News.
Everything we've predicted is coming true. We are seeing that climate change is supersizing the heat waves that we've always had. It's loading the weather dice against us. And this is going to keep on going as long as we keep on burning coal, gas, and oil to provide our energy needs.
While we were out, the right-wing supermajority on the U.S. Supreme Court delivered big gifts to polluters, further stripping federal agencies like the EPA of the authority to require industries to reduce deadly pollution and emissions. The 6-3 ruling overturned the Chevron deference, a decades-old precedent directing judges to defer to an agency's expertise and reasonable interpretations when laws are not explicit. The ruling allows judges to substitute their own ideological and policy preferences. The right-wing supermajority also temporarily blocked the EPA's Good Neighbor Rule that requires power plants and industrial facilities to reduce air pollution that drifts into downwind states, harming their residents. Writing for the majority, Justice Neil Gorsuch mistakenly cited laughing gas rather than the pollutant that causes smog, substituting his own inaccurate opinion for EPA scientists' expertise.
And he did it like 5 times in the opinion, and yet he said the courts should be the one to decide these things rather than the subject matter experts.
Ironic. The court also eliminated the time limit on challenges to federal regulations. So now industries can sue to stop regulations that have been in place for decades. But some better news.
Good.
The Biden administration broke an impasse that has blocked federal heat protections for workers since the 1970s. President Biden proposed the first ever federal rules to protect workers from extreme heat as climate change pushes temperatures to record levels, creating hazardous work conditions. Industry groups already said they will sue to stop the new heat rule as too expensive. The heat rule's fate hinges on the outcome of the presidential election and those Supreme Court rulings, making it much easier to overturn federal regulations.
Just because Neil Gorsuch decides that's the way he wants it.
Yeah.
For much more on all of these stories and more, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com if you can stomach it. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
It's too hot, too hot, too hot, lady. Gotta cool this anger. What a mess we made.
Yes, we did. By the way, the death toll after Beryl in Houston alone is now up to 11.
Yikes.
Since I think we said 3 earlier in the day. With thanks to our producer, Desi Doyen, with apologies to you, our listeners, that is today's broadcast.
Yep.
If you missed any portion of today's show, want to give it another listen or share it with someone you know, love, or hate, you can do it for free at bradblog.com. All of this made possible by those of you kind enough to hit a donate button over there at bradblog.com or go straight to bradblog.com/donate. Drop me an email if you like. I'm bradcast@bradblog.com. On the Facebooks, Mastodons, and sites still known as Twitter, you will find me at TheBradBlog. I believe that's it. Stay cool out there and safe out there until we meet again. We'll see you at all of the above. I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world.
It's too hot, too hot, too hot, lady. Gotta cool this anger. What a mess we made.